Newsmark, sponsored in part by United Airlines. I'm Judy Muller, CBS News.
Senate will come to order.
If only it could. The United States Senate today is ruled, more often than not, by chaos. That great deliberative body of history has become mired in its own inefficiency. Senator Daniel Evans of Washington State has felt that frustration firsthand.
Maybe it's more like mining diamonds. You've got to go through a lot of blue mud before you find one.
Evans is a one-term Republican who's calling it quits this year. And he's not the only one. Virginia Republican Paul Tribble. Florida Democrat Lawton Childs. Evans says he knows at least five senators who probably will not run for re-election when their current terms expire. There's a sense, says Evans, that the whole system is breaking down. Senators spend a lot of time running in place, not to mention running for re-election. President Reagan poked fun at the gridlock on Capitol Hill at a recent dinner for White House correspondents.
There's that Panamanian business going on. One thing I can't figure, if the Congress wants to bring the Panamanian economy to its knees, why doesn't it just go down there and run it?
When did the Senate stop working efficiently? Or is the problem in the system itself? Who holds the real political power today? We'll talk about these and other questions with three men who have witnessed power firsthand. Daniel Evans of Washington State, a three-term governor who went on to become a U.S. senator. New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane, a rising star in the GOP. And journalist Hedrick Smith, author of the best-selling new book, The Power Game. Newsmark, how government works and how it doesn't, will begin in 1 minute.
He started out as a manager of an ice company, but his profits melted. He tried the horseradish business and went bankrupt. Then he decided to duplicate a tangy sauce popular in the Far East. He added an exotic South American vegetable, and the product took off. Who was this man who capitalized on an Oriental recipe and became one of the nation's largest food manufacturers? If you've got a business deal cooking in the Orient, remember United Airlines and the American Express card. United serves 13 cities in 10 foreign countries. And the American Express card is the card rated best by frequent business flyers for their travel and entertainment. From a Singapore sauce known as ketchup came Henry J. Heinz's ketchup. United. Come fly the friendly skies.
The early 1800s are often referred to as the golden age of the United States Senate, the age when statesmen like Daniel Webster and John Calhoun debated the great issues of liberty and union. Today, the debate is before largely empty chambers, such as the debate last February over a campaign reform bill.
I move that the sergeant-at-arms be instructed to arrest absent senators and bring them to the chamber.
The Republicans were playing a parliamentary game. A marathon filibuster was underway, and Majority Leader Robert Byrd was trying to break it by ordering the arrest of GOP senators who were ducking a quorum call. Democrat Dale Bumpers of Arkansas.
What a spectacle. United States senators seeing the sergeant-at-arms coming and take off in a sprint.
Republican Bob Packwood of Oregon was arrested in the midnight roundup and carried feet first into the chamber. The first time in 200 years anything like that had happened. Republican Dan Evans says his reaction was one of real disappointment.
It made the Senate look less dignified than it should, and I don't think it helped at all.
You remember the film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
I surely do. I've seen it many times.
You think I'm licked? You all think I'm licked. Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause.
The stuff of Hollywood? Perhaps. But Washington? Look again. The call went out in June of 1986. Lights, cameras, action. Senate debates would now be televised. Republican leader Robert Dole.
No longer will the great debates in this chamber be lost forever.
The founding fathers powdered their wigs. Some modern-day senators powder their foreheads against the glare of the television lights. Democratic Senator Howell Heflin of Alabama turned tongue-in-cheek for his debut.
Turn the spotlight over here. Focus the camera at my place.
pages, don't come too near, otherwise you might block my face.
But the great debates of the modern Senate are still, by and large, set speeches. And very rarely are more than a handful of senators even listening. That's one reason Senator Dan Evans is leaving. Evans went to Washington in 1983 to finish out the term of the late Henry Jackson. He's highly regarded by his colleagues and constituents, and one might have expected to see him around for a long time to come. But Evans is quitting the Senate, going home to Washington State. He says he's had it with the bickering, the disorganization, and the constant scramble for the TV cameras. In his own words, "I just can't face another 6 years of frustrating gridlock."
It certainly is true that being in the Senate is like the old adage in the Army, it's hurry up and wait. There's a long, long time periods sometimes in waiting for something exciting, interesting, or of major policy to happen. But maybe it's more like mining diamonds. You've got to go through a lot of blue mud before you find one.
Let's start with something positive. Name me something the Senate does well.
Well, I think the ultimate policy that comes out of the Senate is done well. Maybe it's more the way in which we make the sausage, not how the sausage comes out the other end.
You're a student of history and of federalism, and you came to Washington with some idealistic notions about what could be accomplished in the U.S. Senate. What's happened to your more romantic vision of that?
I think the biggest disappointment was, frankly, in the lack of lively exchanges and debate as I thought debate should occur. And, in fact, debate in the way it did occur in the Senate up to maybe a generation ago.
What happens now?
Well, what happens now primarily is that people give fixed speeches to a largely empty chamber.
Let's look at some of the reasons. The overburdened agenda.
I think that's probably the single most difficult problem we face. I come from an average state, average in size of terms of population. I receive from 12,000 to 16,000 letters a month, something over 400 invitations a month, hundreds and hundreds of constituents who come as far away as from the state of Washington to visit. All of those things impinge in one way or another on the time which really ought to be preserved and devoted to committee meetings, floor action, and most of all, thinking, just plain thinking, about the major issues.
Then, says Evans, there's the budget mess, the misuse of the filibuster, the almost constant campaigning for re-election.
I believe that, for instance, if the Senate terms were limited to 12 years, at least half the Senate at any one time would be in their last term and feel considerably more free to speak out and act in ways that weren't so heavily pushed by re-election concerns.
Basically, what you have now, at least in your own words, is a Tuesday through Thursday senator, correct?
Yes, but that's on the way to being corrected. We have, at my suggestion, embarked on a new schedule this year, which calls for five-day work weeks, right from Monday through Friday, for 3 weeks, followed by a week of recess where we can go back home and talk to others.
You realize how bad that sounds to the average working American, that the Senate's going to be forced to work a five-day work week for 3 weeks in a row.
Well,
it's almost funny.
Well, it is, but that is a little deceptive because, in the first place, work days in the Senate are from early until late. A 12 to 14-hour workday is not at all unusual.
Give me an example of how the Senate and congressional life has disrupted, for instance, your home life.
Well, first, it has been a real privilege to serve in the Senate. I knew when I came that it wouldn't be just a regularized existence, but I do think we could do a lot better than we're doing currently. I never know, for instance, when I leave in the morning, whether I will be home for dinner if we don't have something scheduled in the evening, or when. We seldom have dinner at home, even though I live two blocks from the Capitol. We seldom have dinner at home much before 9 o'clock in the evening, and sometimes later than that.
You're quitting the Senate, going back to Washington State.
That's our plan, and certainly is. That Northwest, it's a loud beckoning call.
What will you be doing? Will you still be politically active?
Oh, indeed. I don't plan to have it be in elective political office, but I've had a love affair with American politics for 40 years or better now, and I don't intend to lose that.
But did you find being a chief executive of a state more rewarding than being in the Senate?
For me personally, yes. I like the idea of creating my own program to work with others to develop a comprehensive set of ideas to present to a legislature. I enjoyed the privilege of being able to put those ideas forth with all of the technicolor of a painter, with every color available for his brush.
Governor is a job more and more politicians are beginning to covet. The view from the State House, when Newsmark continues in 1 minute. The nation's state houses have often been seen as stepping stones to higher office.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President
Ronald
of the United
Reagan
States.
Was governor of California before becoming our 40th president. Of the United States. Jimmy Carter was governor of Georgia. For many other former governors, the state house was just one more stop on the road to Capitol Hill. But today, the office of governor is becoming more and more an end in itself. It's an office that's growing in prestige, influence, and power. New Jersey's Tom Kane calls being governor the best job in politics right now. In a recent interview, I asked him why.
You can make decisions, and you can see the decisions go into action. You make a difference in people's lives. I don't think a day goes by that I don't go home at night figuring I may have done something major that affects a lot of people, or maybe it's just helped a few individuals. But every night I feel good about that. Other jobs in government these days, it takes a long, long time to get anything accomplished at all. There's a level of frustration that's amazingly high. And I find as I talk to other governors that frustration level, well, it exists. We're always frustrated. We can't do everything we want to do. But it's not the same. We can get things done.
A successful governor, and you are largely credited with being a successful governor, a Republican in a primarily Democratic state that's managed to win re-election by, what, 70% of the vote, is really in the spotlight nationally now. Do you see that as a transfer? It used to be that all the spotlight was on Washington, and now we're seeing the state houses become the center of attention.
I hope that's right, and hope it's going to continue. It's been traditionally very, very hard for any governor to be recognized, unless you're governor of New York or governor of California. But if you're a governor of New Jersey or Massachusetts or Dakota or wherever, people didn't really know who you were or what you were doing. I think you're right. I think that is changing. And I think people are recognizing the fact that you've got a number of able governors out there in both parties who are really making a difference in the things that are important to people, education, the environment, the economy.
Ann Kane says states are becoming laboratories, developing programs that can be used as models for solving national problems. States and their governors are also becoming part of the international scene.
It's strange, but governors are getting more. And I never ran for governor figuring that I was going to get involved in some of these issues. But I go on trade missions now for the state and the leader of a country. I sat down with the Prime Minister of Israel when I was over there. The leaders of China wanted to see me when I was over. Governors go to promote trade, but they're also looked on as ambassadors of the country when they're there.
Protecting your family from the spotlight. I've interviewed several politicians, and this is becoming, perhaps because fathers are taking a greater role in raising families these days, but it's a greater concern all the time that people have time with their families. Dan Evans cited it as one reason he's quitting the Senate. Do you think something's going to have to give in this area? Because you're not going to attract really good people to politics if they think that they'll have no home life.
It's an incredible problem. I've talked personally to friends of mine whose names you would know who have decided, for instance, not to run for president, solely on one reason. Because
who?
Of their family. I mind who. That was a private conversation. But it's a real problem. I grew up in the city of Washington because I was a congressional brat. My father was in Congress for 20 years, and I saw some families destroyed, and the pressure was much less than it is now. I saw spouses go alcoholic because they never saw their husbands. I saw children who were brought up in very strange situations and had problems because of that. And so I've always been very, very sensitive to that issue. For instance, I never moved into the governor's mansion because at home I can protect my family.
If you were to be elected to the White House, would you not live in it?
Elected to the White House, well, I wouldn't. Frankly, I wouldn't. It's just a personal decision. I would not run for the White House while I had young children.
Obviously, I won't be the first person to ask this question, and I won't be the last. If George Bush were interested in you as a vice presidential candidate, would you be interested in that ticket?
I am not interested. I really do not want to be vice president. On the other hand, you know, if the nominee of the party points the finger and says, really, it is important, and we want you to join with us, it's very hard to say no, and it would be arrogant, really, to say that I'd definitely say no, but I'd want to talk about it with my wife.
But it seems that that would be almost true for any strong leader who would want to be vice president. That's got to be a problem with the job itself. Couldn't the job be changed in some way?
Well, the problem with the vice presidency, and this is the problem George Bush is having now, the job of vice president is totally dependent on the loyalty you show to the president. You've got to do that. It's the job description. George Bush has been one of the best vice presidents this country's ever had, but he's been totally loyal to Ronald Reagan. Now he's going to run in his own right. And at some point or other, he's got to make the demarcation line. He's got to not only spell out the continuation of the Reagan policies that he believes in, but he's also got to spell out for the American people, as two human beings do disagree, where they disagree.
And do you think he's also going to have to spell out exactly what his role was in Iran-Contra?
Oh, I think so. But he believes he's done that pretty well, both in the investigations and the testimonies and everything else.
Do you believe he has?
I do. I sat with George Bush right in the middle of that period. I went to the movies with George Bush, actually, the night before President Reagan held a news conference just after the Iran-Contra was discovered. And he was very upset. And I knew he was upset about something. I didn't know what. And finally, I asked him. I said, you know, you're not enjoying yourself this evening. What is it? And he said, well, this thing is broken. This thing about Iran and all of that. And he said, I don't know very much about it. The president doesn't know very much about it. And he's been talked into holding a news conference tomorrow, which I am opposed to. He said, and I've told the president not to do it until he finds out the facts. I said, let's find out the facts. But the president wants to be totally open. Therefore, he wants to hold a news conference. He said, George Bush said, I think it's going to be a disaster. I think it's a terrible idea. I've told him so, but he's going to do it anyway because Don Regan has told him that he ought to. Well, sure enough, Ronald Reagan held that news conference. It was a disaster because he didn't really know what he was talking about. He hadn't gotten all the facts. And so he said things which he was apologizing for the next, not apologizing, but trying to correct for the next 6 months. Now, you know, based on what George Bush told me privately, I don't believe he knew much about the affair or that, you know, we found out later the president really didn't know much about the affair. And I think, true.
By the way, the movie Governor Kane and Vice President Bush went to see that evening was Top Gun. Newsmark, how government works and how it doesn't, will return in 1 minute. Political power is hard to control. Few leaders can do it well, even fewer for very long. In his best-selling new book, The Power Game, journalist Hedrick Smith says in recent years the rules have changed.
I think what happened, Judy, back in the 1970s, and it actually began in the House, not in the Senate, was a power earthquake that took place, an explosion of power that brought Congress as a whole in rebellion against the president. We had Watergate in Vietnam, as you recall. We had the budget resolutions, the whole budget process, and the War Powers Resolution on foreign policy. And then an upheaval within Congress, a kind of anti-authority mood that swept the country during Vietnam and infected Congress. The members of the House threw out some of the old Southern Committee chairmen. The seniority system was cracked. And at the same time, a tremendous reform in the political financing system for campaigns, which brought a growth and acceleration of the whole money business and special interest politics, and then the dissolving effect of television. Our government is a much harder government to run for any president or for the leaders of either the Senate or the House than it was in the time of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon.
Smith says experience on the state level isn't enough. He says even a man who's been a good governor, like Jimmy Carter, can find the power game inside the Beltway frustrating.
You can't simply send your program up and expect the legislature to pass it because it's an intelligent program. That's what Jimmy Carter thought with his energy program. You've got to build networks and alliances to your own party on Capitol Hill. You've got to include other people in your staff, not just bring your own Georgia mafia. You've got to have a short agenda, not a long agenda. You've got to charm the other politicians. You've actually got to go out and ask for votes. And you've got to be comfortable with power. So there are a lot of ingredients, many of them intangible, that go into success in Washington, particularly for a president.
After Iran-Contra, we've developed a new image of Ronald Reagan, and perhaps after Larry Speaks' revelations that he made up quotes for the president, of a president who really is almost a bit of a puppet. Is that fair, or is it just the image that we're getting because of this compilation of events?
No, I think that that is fair. Power is more complex than either yes or no to that kind of question. Ronald Reagan has some gut attitudes on important policy issues, and he leaves the details to others, and what he considers the details are often the essentials of policy. So he's allowed himself to be put in the position where he's kind of a Wizard of Oz, and other people can make up quotes for him and speak for him and maneuver his policy. The point on Iran-Contra was that Reagan wanted it to happen. He wanted arms deals to be made with Iran, and Ollie North and Bud McFarlane and John Poindexter understood that regardless of what the specific orders were from the president. And he wants Ed Meese to stay in, and he basically wanted to look good when he was meeting with Gorbachev, and that's why he didn't raise a fuss about those quotes that Larry Speaks made up that made Reagan look good. I find it hard to believe that Reagan really didn't know about those when they were issued at the time. So that I think these people are operating within the basic framework of what Reagan wants, but Reagan just gives, more than other presidents that I've known in the 25 years I've been working in and out of Washington, Reagan gives much more power to subordinates than the others used to.
I remember being surprised by the public's reaction to Oliver North when he first appeared before the Senate House panel on Iran-Contra, and the sympathy for the rebel working against the bureaucracy, the man who gets things done, no matter how he does it, if the end is justifiable. Were you surprised at that, or is that touching on what Americans are feeling, this frustration that Congress really doesn't work for them?
I do think you're right that people have a sense of frustration that government doesn't work, and if somebody can finally get something done, then bully for them almost no matter what. But I think after a while, that reaction wore off, and there was a sense that something very important and very bad was going on, and that was you can't get things done if the way you get them done is by doing them in secret and keeping everybody else in the dark and not giving other people who should have a voice in the say of how that policy is determined, denying them a chance even to have the information to affect the policy. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, George Bush, Vice President, is claiming he was out of the loop. I think that's a disaster, and I think you've got that reaction up on Capitol Hill as well as, you know, from somebody like George Shultz very publicly. The name of the game in American government is coalition making. No president, no leader can fake it. No Ollie North can fake it past the system for very long. You can do it for a while, but you can't do it for very long. The only leaders who are really effective are those who can pull those coalitions together.
But coalition building can be difficult at best in a divided government where one party controls the White House and the other party Congress, especially when the players spend much of their time competing for time on television, radio, and in the press. The press, in essence, controls the stage and figures prominently in the Washington power equation. And don't forget money. Fundraising, the almost continual campaigning by members of Congress.
I don't think as voters we're getting our money's worth. And by that I mean they're not in Washington for a full week working on legislation, overseeing policy, getting the business of government done. They're spending at least 3 days a week and sometimes more back in their districts or out in other states raising money. Money has become the obsession of politicians, in part to finance their campaigns, in part so they'll amass such huge war chests way in advance of the campaign that nobody of substance will dare take them on. Judy, the political campaigns in 1986, the congressional campaigns, cost $450 million. It's about five, six times as much as they did only a decade before. The political action committees, there used to be 600 of them. Now they're over 4,000. They contributed in 1974 $8 million. Last time, $135 million. It's skyrocketing.
Writing this book, putting together all of these anecdotes and seeing the frustrations in Congress and the stalemates and the various obstacles, do you come out with a sort of depressing picture on how Washington works? Is it a not very efficient institution?
Well, I come out with a picture that that Washington's not very efficient, that I think we need to beef up the strength of political parties and any forces of cohesion, that we need leaders who are starting to talk to us about forming coalitions instead of beating up on the other party, because that's certainly ridiculous. Neither party can get anything done alone the way things are. But I don't come out depressed. I think there are a lot of people who are very able in Washington. And I think if the public understands a little bit better what's going on in the game, maybe the public itself will change its behavior. Maybe people will stop voting split tickets. So I'm not pessimistic. We do come together at moments of crisis. It's too bad it takes times of crisis to make us come together. Maybe we ought to be thinking about a few of the reforms that would make the system work better. But fundamentally, it's a lot better than Russia, which is where I worked for 3.5 years as a reporter. I'll take the inefficiencies of this system to the problems of that system any day.
Hedrick Smith, author of The Power Game. Newsmark will return in 1 minute. This week's Newsmark, How Government Works and How It Doesn't, was produced by Pam Rauscher. Assistant to the producer, Kathleen Quellen. Technical assistance by Gail Williams and Art Starr in New York, Russ McDaniel in Washington. The senior producer for Newsmark is Norman Morris. Executive producers are Joseph Dembo and Dick Reeves. I'm Judy Muller, CBS News.